Well, good afternoon. This is Pat Moore. I'll be your host today on Juno Afternoon. And today we'll get details on tonight's Evening at Egan presentation. Shad O'Neill will be here to talk about widespread changes to Alaska's glaciers. We'll have a preview of tonight's concert by Sweet Plantain. George Kuhar and Bridget Cross will highlight tonight's movie presentation at the downtown library. And we'll find out about the Girl Scouts' haunted house at the Mendenhall Mall. That, Writer's Almanac, music and more on Juno Afternoon. For the rest of today, the weather calls for rain likely, highs around 44, north winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tonight, rain likely, the same conditions, and the snow is likely to join the rain on Wednesday.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The president of the University of Manitoba testifies at hearings by Canada's Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Halifax. Dan Karpinchuk reports.
David Barnard delivered a public apology to Native leaders. He said he was sorry for his university's role in perpetuating the damage caused by the residential school system. From the late 1800s to the late 1900s, tens of thousands of Native children were taken from their homes and forced to attend residential schools across most of the country. The aim was to help assimilate Native children into white culture. But thousands of those children were physically, sexually, or emotionally abused. Barnard says the university failed to challenge the federal government's policy of forced assimilation.
Education and religion became tools of assimilation, thus undermining the rich diversities of First Nations, Métis, and Inuit cultures, communities, and families.
One of those who was there for Barnard's apology was Florence Painter, herself a residential school survivor. She says the apology means a lot.
We've always said education is really important, and I think that it's education that's also going to change the way that we are in our communities.
The head of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission dismisses criticisms that apologies are meaningless tokens, adding that the university's apology is one of the most important gestures his commission has received. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
People from across the country are focusing on Indian education this week in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Shawnee Hunt is among those attending the National Indian Education Association annual convention. He grew up in the city and says, like many of his students and families, they have lost part of their identity. So he encourages them to use Native language and cultural values at home.
Families can do some of these things. They can start maybe using a little bit of language in their home or on the dinner table, in the car, you know, all these different avenues. Or these different venues that they can use the language to kind of help boost that identity, boost the cultural piece a little bit there.
As the Indian Education Coordinator for the Maple Grove School District in Minnesota, Hunt teaches Native students kindergarten through sixth grade. A recent panel discussion at Seattle University addressed violence against Native women. Eilish O'Neill has more.
Many of those who perpetrate domestic violence on Indian reservations never get charged for those crimes. Nathan St. Goddard, the Assistant Attorney General of the Blackfeet Tribe of Montana, says that the issue is one of jurisdiction.
When the feds taking major crimes over, such as, you know, assault with a serious bodily injury, and them reluctant to do anything about it, coupled with culture, it's just a recipe for disaster, for ongoing domestic violence in the community.
Mandy Moon, a victim advocate for the Port Gamble Skalalam tribe, says that her tribe is working with Kitsap County to make sure that perpetrators stay away from victims.
If you get pulled over by a county sheriff or anybody else and they look it up, they pull your name up in the system, it's not going to be there. So one of the things that we are doing to fix that issue is changing our forms, the forms that we can, and getting the county to recognize them and put them in their systems.
While solving jurisdictional issues is important, Moon argues that the long-term solution for preventing domestic violence is education.
Domestic violence is a learned behavior, so if we educate youth and help break the cycle and let them know that it's not okay, they will not be perpetrators when they grow up.
For National Native News, I'm Alicia O'Neill in Seattle, Washington.
During this week in 1986, Congress enacted the Indian Alcohol and Substance Abuse Prevention Act for tribes to develop and implement treatment and prevention programs. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kiwanis Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Support for National Native News comes from the National Library of Medicine, featuring its new interactive exhibition, Native Voices, examining the concepts of health and medicine among contemporary American Indians, Alaska Natives, and Native Hawaiians. On the web at nlm.nih.gov/native voices. If you are a Native American who experienced discrimination from the USDA while trying to get a farm loan, you can get free legal help with filing a claim at meetings held around the country through December. Details and a schedule of meetings is at indianfarmclass.com or 1-888-233-5506. Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
It's 6 minutes after three. This is Pat Moore hosting Juno Afternoon today. And my first guest is delivering a talk tonight on a very interesting topic. His name is Shad O'Neill. He's with the Alaska Science Association Consortium.
Center,
okay, in Anchorage. And Shad is here to talk on Evening at Egan out at the University of Alaska Southeast. He'll be talking about widespread changes to Alaska's glacier. Welcome, Shad.
Thanks.
So what widespread changes will you be talking about tonight?
Well, I'll try and work my way from Anchorage down the coast towards Juneau, looking at what we know about what's happening to the big glaciers along the coast, which ones are acting the same as the glaciers around the world and which ones are acting somewhat differently. And I'll try and explain what we think is happening as best I can. And then the goal is to try and take that back and think about why it matters and tell people a little bit about why we should care about glaciers or try and understand them better.
I think the thing that most of us know in Alaska is that the glaciers are almost all receding at this point and have been for some time. Is that the center of the change that you'll be talking about?
Yeah, I think it's more than 95% of them are retreating. And what I'd like to do is talk about how we normally think about glaciers and their response to climate, as well as the ones that don't obey climate. And so some of them are retreating much faster than others, and there's a few that are advancing. And so what is it that makes those glaciers special and be able to do different things than a normal glacier? And that turns out to be important because it's some of the bigger glaciers, and they can transfer mass to the sea a lot more rapidly, and so they turn out to be important players in the sea level budget, which is one of the main reasons that we're doing the work that we're doing.
The sea level budget.
So the ocean is rising right now. Sea level's going up in just about all places, but Alaska, we're lucky. We've had a lot of ice removed in the last few hundred years, so the continent here is popping up out of the ocean, so relative sea level is actually falling here. But averaged over the planet, sea level's going up, and mostly that's because glacier ice is melting and adding water into the ocean basin. And so that's one of the primary motivations to study glaciers, is to better understand future sea level change.
A couple of weekends ago, we had a New Zealand musical group in town called Te Waka, and their music is centered around a couple of small islands in the South Pacific. Tuvalu is one of them. Mm-hmm. And I understand that all of these small islands now are beginning to – they're losing ground.
Right. Yeah. The equatorial islands are one of the most – the more strongly impacted regions for sea level, because they're very low-lying islands and because that's where relative sea level changes are maximum.
I know you're a glaciologist, but what else contributes to the rise of sea level?
So there's storage of water in the ground and extraction of water in the ground. So pumping groundwater out or building reservoirs actually plays a component. And then there's the thermal part of the sea level budget. So it's like if you have a bathtub and you put a fire under it, the water level would go up. So that's another term in the sea level budget.
Budget is an interesting number. You think of budget as having only to do with dollars, but you're talking about the volume of water in the.
Yeah, we talk about budgets in science a lot. I think we're always trying to think of all the different terms that sum together to create some entity like the sea level or a glacier mass budget. So we For glaciers, we measure how much it snows and how much it melts, and we difference those two, and that turns out to be the mass budget for each glacier.
So the water in a glacier is fresh water.
Mm-hmm.
And as this goes into the ocean, does it change the salinity of the ocean?
It does, yeah.
To what degree?
Well, I don't have a number for you, but it can play an important role. Like some of the waters in the Gulf of Alaska are more fresh than the open ocean. It depends on the shape of the different bays and stuff, whether they're well connected to the ocean or not. And it's also one of the projects that I'm working on is starting to look at that for the Gulf of Alaska as a whole, to try and understand if, as the glaciers go away, if the ocean chemistry will change.
When you say you're going to be working on this project, could you describe the process that you think you'll go through? How will you work on
it? Yeah, so we start by writing a proposal and submit the proposal. It's evaluated by peer reviewers and a panel. And that proposal was selected to be funded. And in this case, it's mostly an idea-building proposal. We're trying to – there's some substantial socioeconomic reasons to work on the Gulf of Alaska. The fisheries is one of the big ones that provides motivation for us. And not much has been done, so we've kind of got a blank sheet of paper to work with and trying to figure out first how the glaciers are changing and then how the water is delivered into the ocean and then what kind of impacts it has in the ocean, whether it's changing the chemistry enough to affect primary productivity and how that feeds into the food chain.
So it sounds like the first step of this is more of a pencil and paper exercise than actually going out in the field and taking samples of
exactly.
salt water and that sort of thing.
Yeah, and with this kind of work, it's not like you could go out and instrument the whole coastline. So we're more interested in what data is already being collected. Mm-hmm. And there's so many different divisions of science that are working on the different data inputs that we would need to understand this ecosystem. So we're kind of knocking on doors and finding out what's available that might be useful for this project.
I think the first step in any research undertaking, I was taught back in some master's degree program way back when, is to try to figure out what's been done already and then to see if any of that answers the question that at hand.
Right. It's not all that productive to reinvent the wheel over and over and over.
So since you're not going to be reinventing the wheel, how does your past work with glaciers play into this new direction that you might be going?
Well, one thing that we're really focused on is trying to understand how important the glaciers that end in the ocean, the tidewater calving glaciers, they can behave more like light switches, and a terrestrial glacier behaves more like a dimmer switch. If you change the temperature or precipitation rate, it slowly adjusts. But the calving glaciers can switch on and off without much reason, and we don't understand that.
But switch on and off. Switch what?
So they can go from being very stable to unstable overnight.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's confused us and that we're not fully understanding how it works or why it happens. But when they do go unstable, they can drain ice rapidly and they can change the ocean most rapidly. So we have over 50 of these tidewater glaciers in Alaska that are all in various stages of retreat or advance. The only advancing glaciers in Alaska are calving glaciers. And we'd like to be able to have more certainty about what might happen in the future. And right now we don't. And so if we could, we have a really robust set of measurements from Columbia Glacier, which is in Prince William Sound.
You've done most of your work with
work
Columbia.
Up at Columbia mm-hmm. Glacier, yeah. Quite a bit of work up there. And we want to be able to use that as a case study to say what might happen at other calving glaciers in Alaska, as well as with the land terminating glaciers being able to say, well, can we take measurements from one glacier and apply them over a broad region? And that's something that's just in its infancy.
The broad region business raises the concept that glaciers are not really just an Alaskan phenomenon. They're a global phenomenon. Where else are there calving glaciers being studied?
One of the big research emphasis right now is in Greenland, and it's the outlet glaciers that drain the ice sheet. So there's calving glaciers that flow down off the ice sheet, and they behave really similarly to the tidewater glaciers here. They're in narrow, deep fjords, and they have the same instability where they can go from stable to unstable very, very quickly. And the calving glaciers around the world, and there's similar ones in Antarctica, and there's up in the Canadian Arctic as well, but they're really the wild card right now. They're what we don't understand, and they have the ability to change the rate of sea level rise quickly, whereas the glaciers where the climate and melting and snow accumulation rates sort of dictate their shape, they contribute more to the slow change in the glaciers.
Chad, are you presenting tonight in the theater or over in the library?
It's in the theater.
In the theater,
yeah,
okay.
The lecture hall.
Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. So your presentation starts at 7 o'clock.
Yep.
It's at the University of Alaska. This is the regular evening at Egan lecture, but tonight it's on the topic of widespread changes to Alaska's glacier. And Dr. Chad O'Neill, who's with the Alaska
Science Center.
Science Center.
USGS. Okay. Yeah.
USGS, Alaska Science Center up in Anchorage. So we look forward to hearing more about glaciers tonight.
Thanks.
Let's hear a tune right now about a glacial erratic by a Juno group here.
If I was a rock, I'd be an erratic. Out on my own,
far from my home.
I'd be carried by the ice, I'd be carried by the snow.
McDonald's, now serving the McRib sandwich. McDonald's, open daily on Trout Street in the Valley.
It's 20 minutes after 3. Pat Moore, your host on Juno Afternoon. My two guests are two members of a group which is performing tonight here in Juno. Sweet Plantain, an interesting name. You don't find a band named after a banana very often, I don't think, or a banana's cousin, I guess. And so Joe and Orlando are here. These are two of the four members of the quartet, although mm-hmm. on your website you've also got a fifth guy who plays trombone, I think.
Yes.
Yeah,
our regular violinist
is one
of the founding members. This is Joe. Hello. Eddie Venegas, he's not
with us on this tour. He's touring with Mark Anthony. He writes a lot of the music for the group, and he is one of the regular members of the group. Mm-hmm.
Having him along would make it difficult to introduce you as a quartet, wouldn't it?
Well, we always travel as a group of four people.
I see.
And he just doubles on the trombone.
He doubles on both instruments, which is rare.
So not both at the same time. He hasn't learned that yet. I think he's studying that on his tour now.
Who was the – there was a sax player who used to play two horns at the same time. I can't remember.
I cannot recall the name, but I think I know.
He used to drone one sax and finger the other one, sticking out of both sides of his mouth. It was an amazing thing to visually to see visually. So Sweet Plantain plays an eclectic mixture of music. You go all the way from classic, and then in the middle of the thing, something will start to creep in, and it'll get more and more pop, and then eventually it goes even to hip hop. Mm-hmm. That is an odd place for a classically trained quartet of violinists and cello players and viola players to wind up. How did that happen?
Well, we've all come into this group with roots in other styles of music, even though we are classically trained. Joe came into this really with a very blues and rock background. I came into this with a jazz and fusion, like 70s fusion background with what I grew up listening to. I actually have an uncle that's a jazz drummer, and I used to go and hear his gigs a lot when I was a kid. So even though I didn't necessarily study jazz playing when I was a kid, it's in my blood and it's in my ears. And so it's something that I came into this group with, even with the classical training.
But yeah, I had the classical training, but I think most of my childhood, I knew I didn't want to be a full-time classical musician. I got the rock bug at an early age and, you know, learned guitar and electric bass and started singing and writing songs and playing in bands. And that's sort of what I wanted to do. I actually have a rock band I sing and play in called Stratospherious.
Stratospherious
is the name of the group. But so it's sort of very natural. I went to school for jazz. I double majored in classical violin and jazz violin. So, you know, joining this group was a real natural fit for me. It's a lot of things that I love to play, and it's also classically oriented as well. So, it's just fun. You never know where you're going to end up. If you have a lot of different things you can do, life could take you in a lot of cool places, I think.
So how much of your music how much do you guys key off of each other and change? Is there an improvisational component to what you do?
Oh, yes.
A large extent?
Very much so.
Absolutely.
So you're off the score 5 minutes after the concert starts, is it?
Well, I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
There's a structure to each piece.
Certainly.
And some pieces are all written out and we play them as written. But some, there's a structure and then there's an area where we could improvise. And sometimes if one of us has a brain fart and goes into the wrong section, like what happened this morning,
yes, I do.
The other person just echoes what this guy did. It makes it sound like it was part of the score.
Yeah, you just go with it.
You were in school this morning someplace doing
We played in Petersburg at an elementary school.
Yeah.
So sometimes that's when something fun like that happens that's spontaneous. Mm. You make it work and there is no wrong. It becomes part of the part of the music.
And sometimes the most brilliant musical moments come out of those little mistakes.
Absolutely.
What we call happy accidents.
Absolutely. And you got to open yourself – be in the moment, opens yourself up to those kind of things.
Which leads me to my – how does that feel? When all of a sudden you hear the viola viola?
Yes.
Viola. Okay.
Yes.
All of a sudden you hear the viola going someplace that you didn't expect because it's not written down on the page. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about that? Is there a moment of panic there? Can I go with this guy?
There's never a moment of panic.
No, never panic.
Maybe there was a time earlier in my life where there would be a moment of panic, mm-hmm. but now I just follow him – wherever he goes, and then it's fun trying to figure out a way to get back. Let's work with this moment and see where it takes us. And,
there's also an element of trust, I think.
There's an element of trust. It's like the game where you close your eyes and you fall and someone catches you. There's very much that element in our group.
I think it gives us a lot of flexibility. I feel like I can do pretty much whatever I want, and I have the support of the people around me. Mm-hmm. If I feel like I have an idea and I want to go in this direction, they are going to go with me. Kicking and screaming, but they will go with me.
Now, the granddaddy of quartets that moved away from the classical image is Kronos.
That's one of them.
So the question is, are you different from Kronos? Are you going – are you taking it around? Is it bending around like the banana you're named after? How does this
– Well, there's been a few groups that that if Kronos was one of the first, were the trailblazers, but they specialize more in contemporary.
Yeah, it's.
I don't want to use the word classical, but new music, so to speak.
Right, but that's all. Everything is written. I don't think there was as much of an improviser.
They're not very much an improvising group. Mm-hmm. There's also groups like Ethel that also they improvise a little, but they're more new music oriented. Turtle Island String Quartet, big influence on me.
Oh, absolutely, Uptown String Quartet.
Uptown String Quartet.
Yeah, Maxine Roach's group.
But all those groups do their own thing. You know, Turtle Island does jazz. They call it American vernacular, more jazz and folk and bluegrass and things like that. I think this group, as a fan, before I joined the band, you know, the main thing that stuck out with me was the Latin American influence and the hip-hop influence, which I hadn't seen other quartets
haven't really seen
you know, that. Meld so you know, intricately and in an interesting way. And that attracted me to it. So there's plenty of room, I think, for string quartets to be creative and blaze new trails. It's you know, as deep a history as string quartets have had, there's still a lot of room to do new things, I think, you know.
A classic music group that slides across into the hip-hop pop world loses a kind of – I don't know. I guess maybe I shouldn't say that because you need to tell me if that's the case. Do you lose some chops with the musical world?
Absolutely not.
Really?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
No, I don't think so. As a matter of fact, I have a great deal of respect for musicians that are able to improvise and to think so quickly. And you have to have a certain, you know, if you're talking about chops as far as, you know, the ability
technique.
On the instrument and technique, you need a great deal of technique to be able to do this and think on the fly. And you have to have great problem-solving technique.
And you have to be able to execute what's in your head.
Exactly.
And, you know, and without technique, that's hard to do.
Orlando has the most delightful smile on his face when he says this. You like what you do, don't you?
I do. I really do. I really enjoy doing this.
We consider ourselves very blessed and fortunate to be able to do this for a living.
Do you feed the does the audience feed you guys?
Oh, absolutely.
How does that
Beyond
work?
Beyond a doubt. Oh,
there's no question.
What happens to the music?
In any performance, there is a collective energy between the audience and performer, and you definitely feed off of that. There's, you know, you get this energy. You can tell, and particularly in the audiences that we've had here, they're so engaged because I think it's something that they haven't heard before, and you can sense that energy that they're, you know, it's like they're goading you, you know, and, you know, what, you know, give me more, and so we give it. You know, that happens.
I tend to say, you know, and we all live in New York, and I love New York. You know, it's one of my favorite places in the world. But people are so bombarded with stuff all the time, with so many choices of entertainment. Yeah. They tend to get a little jaded. When you travel outside of New York, especially in smaller towns, people are so grateful that you made the trip there to entertain them. They're so grateful that you're there, and you feel that love from people, that enthusiasm, you know, and it's like, yeah, this is why I'm a musician.
You know? You need to know that you're walking into a musical hotbed here. Yes. I mean, this town has more musicians per capita, I think, than any place I've ever lived in my life.
Yes. I'm actually talking about smaller towns that we've been to around Alaska and other parts of the country.
You'll find a great deal of musical talent in small towns in Alaska. I mean, we're isolated up here, and if you've got an axe, you use it to chop down trees. So there's a lot of musicians around here, and when we do the Folk Fest in March, April, people come from all over the southeast, well, all over Alaska to come down here and play in these 15-minute sets. And it is amazing when you sit through 3 days of that and you think to yourself, how can this get any better?
Right.
That's great.
So, that's something I would love to see.
So you have an audience here that is ready, ready, willing, and able to be taken anywhere you want to go with your music. Mm-hmm. So the concert tonight starts at 7 o'clock. Mm-hmm. It's at the Jack. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And y'all will be there with bells on, I guess. Huh?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think some of us will be too. So
we're looking forward to
Orlando, Joe, I'll be looking forward to sitting a couple of rows back and listening to some of this stuff tonight. Thank you very much. Let's listen to a little of it right now, shall we?
Thank you.
Music there by Sweet Plantain. They'll be playing tonight starting at 7 o'clock at the Jack. Better rush over there and get tickets right away. My next two guests are also musicians. And here it is, 3:33 in the afternoon. We're going to talk with two people who have written a score for a silent film. Bridget Cross and George Cuhar have done this once before, and now they are doing it for The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, which is a German, the very first, I think, German film noir parent kind of thing from the silent era. So how did you come to be writing scores for silent movies?
That's something that actually happens quite often down in the lower 48 states. Contemporary groups will write scores for silent films, and sometimes silent films that their copyright has expired, and so they're open public domain. Often groups will create a new score and release a new DVD with the whole thing. a couple years ago, I guess in 2008, we did this for another German film, Nosferatu, which is a vampire film. It's basically the story of Dracula, which is such a great story. It's been told so many times, you know. We did it for that movie for Halloween of 2008, and it went really well. And we keep planning on, hopefully, we'll do that movie again someday. But our friend Jonas, who works at the library, approached us with doing this movie. And so we took it up, and it's going to be showing Saturday night at the library downtown.
Jonas was here to tell us a little bit about that, and as part of another interview, we talked about the new language program at the library. He's the public outreach person for the Juno Libraries. So, Bridget, what's the instrumentation for the piece you've put together for Caligari?
Instrumentation is electronic. Mm-hmm. I'm playing an old synthesizer, not that old. No, 90s?
80s.
I guess that's kind of old now.
Okay, I guess
so. And you're playing I'm not sure what it is. It's a MIDI synthesizer that goes through mm-hmm. a bunch of
yeah.
different things.
I have software synthesizers that I play through a MIDI keyboard.
Oh, okay. So the synthesizer's in like computer programming, mm-hmm. and then you're jacked into the computer and playing a keyboard too.
Yeah, that's right.
Right, okay. Have you done this kind of thing for other than silent movies, I assume?
Not exactly. I'm working on a score for a project that the university is sponsoring. I'm working with Lucid Reverie, and they're putting together a documentary film, and I'm working on a score for that right now. But for silent films, not really so much. That is actually something that we would be more interested in doing, is doing more score-type work.
There's a close relationship between keyboarded synthesizers and organs. And the original accompaniment for a lot of silent films was a house organ in a theater. As a matter of fact, the organ that's played in the State Building every Friday at lunchtime was in a silent theater here in Juneau for many years.
Oh.
It was moved over there. And part of the reason for that big glass case that's got all of the drums and stuff inside it is because it was the orchestra for silent films in this town for a while.
Wow.
So I guess did you reach back into that organ-based silent film? A lot of those things were improv. People would be watching the movie and sort of noodling it out on the organ as they were going. Did any of that affect your when you were putting this together?
Yes. I think we definitely are doing a lot of noodling with the organ.
Uh-huh.
It's true.
Yeah. Some of it's definitely very planned out, and then some of it is definitely just trying to not think about it and feel it more. Just like keep the eyes glued on the screen and keep all the senses open and try and let the impressions from the film hit your body and then come out of your fingertips without going through the brain.
So to what extent is tonight's score scored?
Or tomorrow's score.
Tomorrow's score, sorry.
Maybe half. Maybe half.
And yeah. So the other half is going to happen as the film.
As it happens, yeah.
You've watched this film, I would imagine.
Quite a few times, yeah.
To score it, right?
And it's really kind of maddening because it's about centered in an insane asylum.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know,
We're kind of going crazy ourselves.
We are. It's affecting us.
So how do you play with the straitjacket on? Is that does that?
It's
we
really
try
hard.
It. I know.
Sort of have to stand sideways and get your fingers over onto the keyboard.
Yeah, I use my toes.
Okay, this synthesizer that you're playing, the older one. Why did you choose to do not a modern synthesizer? Is there a unique sound or a unique? Were you looking for something specific?
It was what was available.
Oh, okay.
It's what we have.
Yeah. We've got to work with what we have.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is from, do you know when it was manufactured?
In the 80s, I'm pretty sure.
Okay. Transistors, not tube, not far as back, not as far back as
not,
a tube type.
Back, yeah.
So it's not a Moog or a theremin or something like that.
No, but I am using a...
A Moog pedal, yeah, it is running through a ring oscillator. That's what it's
called. Oh, okay. I'd ask you what that is, but I'm not sure if you did explain it that we'd be any better off. But
yeah, right.
Very horror movie right. sounding.
Okay, yeah. Okay. So and you when you are thinking okay, so does that idea come with the movie, before the movie, after the movie, when you know you're going to need that sound? When do you know that?
I think it's kind of. Sometimes with creating art and having a project in front of you is just about accepting some sort of fate in the matter. Mm-hmm. It's like, hey, this is what I'm into right now. These are the instruments that I just happen to be playing right now. These are the sounds that I'm into right now. Oh, and this project has come to meet me at my front door. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, let's go take a walk together, kind of like that.
Yeah. So a lot of your ideas grow out of the fact that there's a confluence between what you've been doing and the project all of a sudden, and then you're off.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
Okay, Bridget, is that the same for you?
Well, yeah, at this point, yeah. I'm just kind of going along with yes.
So
yes.
I guess that raises the question. So is this George's score or George and Bridget's score or Bridget's score that you let George play along on? Or how does the partnership between the two of you play into the music?
I think it's definitely George's main score, and I kind of augment it. Yeah, I fill it in, round it out. Hmm. That's what I think is happening. But I'm not clear entirely. The project's not really that focused. So I definitely have a lot of input, but I think I do, don't I?
Yeah.
Okay.
Do you two know each other?
It's this film. It's really getting to us. Yeah. Not sure what's real anymore.
And that's the crux of the film is there comes a point where you're like, I don't know what's real anymore. Because the characters don't.
Yes.
There's kind of a breaking down.
Be careful now. That's a spoiler. I have to give a 5-minute spoiler alert and tell everyone to turn their radios off if they don't want to know how this comes out. So be very, very careful at this point. Anyway, I do have to say that Caligari was a real breakthrough concept in silent films. It was the first film really that got any widespread notice that went into people's minds to the extent that it does. Psychological thrillers are now so commonplace that all of us expect a certain amount of, you know, head shrinking involved in almost anything. We always have to know what the motivation of the character is and things like that. But the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari was one of the very first, I think the guy's name is Vida, the guy who directed it. It was one of the first films that really tried to bring to the screen what was going on in a disturbed mind and make that visual for us so that we could kind of go into that mind with that person. That's probably one of the reasons you're feeling some of the emotions you are, is because he was very good at it. Mm-hmm. He did it with lighting and he did it with camera angles and a set which was drawn largely and is in a very expressionistic style.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the wonderful thing of it popping back and forth between expressionism and the real world that happens a couple mm-hmm. of three it's, times in the film.
It's very erratic.
Yeah.
You know, the set is very dramatic. And then the way the scenes play out, too, are definitely – we found that to be a challenge when working on the music, is that the scenes happen so erratically that it's very demanding on us musically to figure out how we're going to move with that kind of erratic – play in the storyline.
So, George, you brought us along. Is this a piece of the music from Caligari mm-hmm. that we're going to hear?
Yes, we okay. recorded it this morning.
Oh, right. No. I forgot we did that even.
Wow. So this was this is fresh off of the synthesizer, I guess. Huh?
Yeah. Fresh off the chips.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's take a listen here.
Okay.
So, George, as we were listening to this, you were telling me that this occurs at the very beginning, but it also recurs throughout the score that you've done.
Mm-hmm.
Why did you do that?
Because to bring ideas back to some sort of streamline. You know, when we watched the movie for the very first time with the sound off and no music, it was kind of hard to follow. Because it's erratic, like I was saying. So it is helpful to use the music to try and help glue together some of the story. And even the themes that we have written aren't necessarily assigned very strictly to a certain character or a certain situation, but they do somehow seem to add up to the way the pieces of the puzzle fit together.
Oh. So, in actuality, your score almost becomes another dimension of the movie. It was what you were...
Indeed.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. This will be playing Saturday night at the library. Starts at 6:30, I think.
The door's at 6:30.
Door's at 6:30, yeah. And the film after, and it's fairly short. I think it's like an hour and 15 minutes or something mm-hmm. like that. Yeah. Okay. And live performance. You'll be there playing this music as the film unfolds in front of us all. Okay, well, an interesting and fascinating project. Thank you so much for spending the time to do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Friday. It's the 28th of October, 2011. 1919, on this day, Congress overrode President Woodrow Wilson's veto and passed the Volstead Act, which provided for enforcement of the 18th Amendment to the Constitution prohibiting the sale of alcohol. The Prohibition movement, led largely by women who had a hard time making a living on their own, and many of them had seen their lives ruined when their husbands squandered the family income on alcohol. The law was not so enforced in big cities. and so prohibition was not so effective there. But in rural areas, it was. And when prohibition was in effect, death rates from cirrhosis of the liver fell by more than 50%, and admissions to state mental hospitals for alcoholism fell as well. It was on this day in 1886 the Statue of Liberty was officially unveiled and opened to the public. There was a big ceremony in front of the statue, which was under a veil. The sculptor Frederic Auguste Bartholdi was alone in the crown of the statue, waiting for the signal to drop the veil. A speaker was droning on, and Bartholdi mistook the signal, dropped the veil, and the speaker sat down. It's the birthday of Evelyn Waugh, born in London, 1903, author of Bride's Head Revisited and many other novels. And it's the birthday of the man who developed the polio vaccine, Dr. Jonas Salk, born in New York City, 1914. The vaccine released to the public in 1955, and the number of people infected by polio went down from more than 10,000 a year to less than 100. Here's a poem for today by Louise Glick, In the Plaza. For 2 weeks, he's been watching the same girl, someone he sees in the plaza, in her 20s maybe, drinking coffee in the afternoon, the little dark head bent over a magazine. He watches from across the square, pretending to be buying something, cigarettes, maybe a bouquet of flowers, because she doesn't know it exists. Her power is very great now, fused to the needs of his imagination. He is her prisoner. She says the words he gives her in a voice he imagines, low-pitched and soft, a voice from the South, as the dark hair must be from the South. Soon she will recognize him, then begin to expect him, and perhaps then every day her hair will be freshly washed. She will gaze outward across the plaza before looking down, and after that they will become lovers. But he hopes this will not happen immediately, since whatever power she exerts now over his body, over his emotions, she will have no power once she commits herself. She will withdraw into that private world of feeling women enter when they love. And living there, she will become like a person who casts no shadow, who is not present in the world. In that sense, so little use to him, it hardly matters whether she lives or dies. In the Plaza by Louise Glick, from A Village Life, published by Ferris Strauss and Giroux, and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, partners with the National Endowment for the Arts in Poetry Out Loud, a national poetry recitation contest for high school students. More information at poetryfoundation.org. And by the Mosaic Foundation of Rita and Peter Hayden, based in Ann Arbor, honoring the literary arts and the universe of great ideas. Written by Betsy Allister. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
It's about 9 minutes before four. This is Pat Moore. I'm the host today for Juno Afternoon, and I have a studio full of people here with me. This is Girl Scout Troop 4029, and I have three beautiful young ladies who are standing here, and they are doing a really interesting project that you get to take part in, everybody in the radio audience. So, Jamie, let's start with you. Tell me why you decided to come down here and talk about this.
Well, it's just a fun little Girl Scout tradition.
So what is it?
It's a haunted house.
Ah.
And you get to go and be spooked by everyone who's there.
So where is this haunted house, Kara?
It's at the Nugget Mall.
Okay. And Nara, when can I come see it?
Tonight at 6 to 8.
6 to 8, okay. And then is it on again?
Yes, or is, okay. On Sunday and Saturday, I think 12 to 4.
In the background, they're being prompted by the troop leaders. So let's introduce them as well. This is Kim Hort, whom I think you're Jamie's mom, right?
Yes, I'm Jamie and Kara's mom.
Okay,
and
okay.
I just want to clarify, it's actually taking place at the Mendenhall Mall.
At the Mendenhall Mall. Okay, not the Nugget Mall. This is the Mendenhall Mall where the library is, mm-hmm. and like that. Okay, good. Out in the valley. All right. And so where are you in the mall? What can somebody give me a relationship to a store? This lady who's about to talk to you is Corrine Conlon.
Yeah, so we have gotten space. The Mendenhall Mall, again, for the second year, has allowed us space in the mall. And so we're kind of right across from the library, kind of from the restrooms, so right there in that space. And,
okay.
And we're pretty obvious.
So the big glass wall is on the front of the library. You go down there where it turns down and goes to the restrooms, look right opposite there, and there's the haunted house.
Exactly.
Okay, I think for a while there was a miniature golf operation in there.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. All right. And the other person with us in the studio is Anne Kirtland. And Anne, you're with a different troop. One of you.
Yep. I have a troop of older girls. They're cadet Girl Scouts in middle school, 4019. And lots of Girl Scouts from Juneau are helping out with the haunted house from lots of different troops.
So, what is it? How many people does it take to staff a haunted house with Girl Scouts?
Well, we have. At least a dozen ghouls at a time haunting the house.
Okay. Now, I know in one of the other haunted houses, this is really a question for the girls, they have over in the other mall, they have a haunted house over there that the Boy Scouts are running, and they have someone run through and adjust the horror level. Are you doing that, or are you one horror fits all on this place?
Well, it's mostly just like you walk through and then you can just see scary stuff and people just spook at you.
Ah, okay. And
what do you do if someone really little is going through who's already scared?
Well, we don't really try scaring them. We just kind of act slowly, but with, like, teenagers, we actually try,
You amp it up as high as you can get it, right?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Serves them right for being teenagers, doesn't it? Okay. Does it cost?
Yes. There is $5 per person, $20 per family, and all scouts are free.
All scouts are free. Do they have to be in uniform? Or?
No.
Oh, okay. Just show their scout salute or something and they're in the door, right? Okay. All right. And this will go on now tonight. It's open at 6, did you say? Yeah, 6 to 8. And then Saturday and Sunday, and we were kind of confused about the hours. When is it open, Saturday and Sunday?
It's open from 12 until 4 on Saturday and Sunday.
Okay, both days 12 till 4. Okay, so can you give me any idea of what I would see if I walked through the house without giving away too much?
You would see Dr. Death,
ooh,
a ghostly feast.
That's probably more. No, be careful now. Don't give away too much.
And
we have to make them pay $5 to see the good stuff.
A little graveyard.
Ooh. Is there music? Is there ghostly music in the back? Oh, okay. All right.
Yes, there's very scary music. Very
scary. So let me, Jamie, what did you do when you were building what was your part in building the haunted house?
I haven't been there yet, but I'm going tonight.
Okay, so you're managing, taking the money, and do you lead people through, or do you?
Yeah, there's tour guides that walk through.
So is that what you're doing tonight?
I think so.
Oh, okay. All right. And Kara, did you help build the thing?
Not exactly,
Can you tell about the costume that you wore last
night?
Okay. I wore
Well, basically everybody wore their Halloween costume or a costume.
Oh, okay. So you were open last night. You had guests going through victims. What is the proper term? I guess someone is a victim who goes through a haunted house, right? Okay. Well, Troop 4029 and other Girl Scouts assisting with this venture, running a haunted house at Mendenhall Mall, open tonight, tomorrow during the afternoon, and on Sunday during the afternoon. $5 to get in, $20 for a family. Anyone who wants to play can come. Let's close this out with a little Halloween music.
Skeleton bones, skeleton bones. I hate the sound of skeleton bones. Click, clack, clickety clack. I hate the sound of skeleton bones.
Tomorrow on Juno Afternoon, Jeff will be talking with Jan Caulfield and Jim Calvin about the master plan for Eagle Crest and how you can take part. Jenny Bredeen will be here talking about kinder music classes that are coming up. And he'll talk with filmmaker Peter Baxter about the movie Superheroes. It's playing this week at the Goldtown Nickelodeon. There'll also be Writer's Almanac, Birdmoat, music, and more. And that'll all on Monday on Juno Afternoon. This is KTOO Juno. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juno and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley in Auk Bay, you can tune to K276AF. It transmits on 103.1. When you're driving through Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, or if you live there, K2690 will give you a clear signal at 101.7. Gustavus is at K201 AM. That's the call sign of the translator there that runs on 88.1 megahertz. A translator K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210AS. It translates on 89.9. On GCI Cable Juno, we're on digital channel 871, and our sister stations KRNN and KXLL can be heard on 872 and 873. We're also online at www.